Welcome to Deep Dive MH370, Episode 27, Landing MH370. Hello, I'm Andy Tarnoff, the publisher and founder of OnMilwaukee.com, a daily magazine and city guide and media company based in Milwaukee. And once again, I am joined by Jeff Wise, aviation journalist, international TV star, apparent slight Russian speaker, and author of Taking of MH370, and I'm going to say star, or at least main guy in the Netflix documentary, MH370, The Plane That Disappeared. Jeff, it is time to move into a new phase of the podcast.
Yeah, I think that's true, Andy. We really got very granular trying to establish a rock solid foundation on some of the big picture items that we were kind of aiming at for our 10th anniversary. I think we established that. I think people seem to have been like, okay, we're buying it. Okay. So now what people are saying, and what I'm hearing from the comments and people emailing me and stuff, is, okay, great. You've sort of raised questions about why it probably didn't go south. What would have happened if it went north? And I think that's maybe for the next couple episodes, we're going to sort of peel the onion on that a little bit.
As we talked about in the last episode, that is the question that people always ask me, because I'm sure, like you, you've discussed this with 10 million people, and they always say, all right, fine. Where and why?
Why?
And today we are going to talk about where.
Yeah.
Frankly, this is the part that I'm most interested in, because also, as we talked about last week, I like to cut to the chase, and I know you're more of a methodical storyteller, but to me, the two pieces kind of work together, because it's all well and good to say the plane didn't go here, or maybe the plane didn't go here, but then you need the second part, which is maybe the plane went here.
Yeah, I mean, it's fine to say, okay, listen, in the first part, we see the plane heading in this direction, so maybe that's the direction it went in. If in the second part, you're like, but yeah, it's actually, there was a huge wall that it couldn't have gone through or something. If we ran into some impenetrable barrier, whether literally or figuratively, that would be a problem. We would have wasted everyone's time. On the contrary, it gets just more and more interesting, in my estimation, as we sort of follow this thread further along the path. And so I think what we want to do today is look at the first part of that next stage of our journey, which is we're looking north, and we've posited that the plane went to the north. We've, in a previous episode, looked at where it would have gone, what air bases it would have gone near, where radar might have been that would have detected it, if any. And we kind of, where we left it, is that it was reaching its final transmission, the so-called seventh arc, and this was over Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
And so what we're going to look at today is, okay, if it went this way, if it got as far as this, what next? And
for
I think
sure.
Presumably, if somebody went through all, we've described a very elaborate, very sophisticated, very time intensive, and somewhat risky undertaking. And so the question would be, well, presumably they didn't want to just die. Their plan wasn't to like fly it 6 hours north and then just like, whatever, we'll wing it. We'll take ourselves to a desert with like vast, empty, scrubland where like you really can't land at 777.
Yeah.
Presumably they would have had a goal in mind.
You would think it wouldn't be a suicide mission, but certainly if Russian former KGB agents were participating in it, the possibility of death existed. So I don't want to rule that out.
I mean, There's a difference between a possibility of death, which I think any military slash espionage person, you know, has to be aware of, and a suicide mission where you're like, I have no realistic expectation of surviving. I think whoever did this seemed very motivated.
Yeah.
And I don't think you get someone who's very motivated to do a series of really complicated and arcane things and then just die. That
True.
Seems really hard to swallow. So basically, we were looking for a place where this plane could land. The idea being you've flown through the middle of the night, thousands and thousands of miles. You've flown to Central Asia, and you're now going to look for a place to land where you can then either somehow hide the plane right where you are or refuel it and go somewhere else.
Right. So if people have, if they're hearing this for the first time, presuming they have not watched or listened to every single episode that we have published, we referred to this in great detail in episode 13. Mm-hmm. So that is a really interesting one to go back and rewatch. It's actually one of my favorite ones because it opened up my brain's possibility that this could have actually really happened. It sounded very theoretical until right. we spelled it out like that. So yeah. this is predicated on having a general understanding of why the plane could have gone north and how it could have gotten away with it.
There's a lot of technical reasons why the plane probably went north. One of the main objections that people instinctively had, which is what the main thing we were trying to address in episode 13, is, wait, wouldn't it have been seen
right.
by all these countries' radar? And we basically followed the entire path as it went over India, over Nepal, over part of China, up into Central Asia. And we said, actually, there isn't any radar probably that would have seen it.
Yeah. Yeah. So this isn't just clickbait. We're saying really go back to episode 13 and watch it, right. and it'll make a lot more sense to you.
Yeah.
So we talked in episode 13, we talked about how scientists at the Australian government organization called the Defense and Technology Group, they used this
Science and Technology Group.
They used this yeah. Monte Carlo modeling, right. which we referred to in our last episode. So I guess I'm saying two different things right. to generate these number of possible routes that matched the BTO yeah. data. And they did have this probability distribution that looked like what I'm putting on the screen right now.
Yeah. So if you just use the BTO data, and we've talked about this many times, you get two routes. One is a mirror image of the other. One is the real route that the plane actually flew, and the other is its mirror image. And just on BTO alone, you don't know which it is. And then there's right. this other part of the data called BFO that tells you which of those is the correct one. The whole premise of this podcast is pretty much to raise the possibility that BFO data was spoofed so that it looked like that the plane actually went into the Southern Indian Ocean when it really took the northern one. So what we're going to be talking about today is the idea that if the BTO route to the north is the one that the plane actually took, where could it have landed? Where could this plane, after being hijacked, have landed so that the hijackers could survive and go on to enjoy the fruits of their success?
And not to be too repetitive, but again, this was another topic that we talked about repeatedly with the spoofing scenario. So if you're just hearing this for the first time, this will make more sense if you go back and watch a yeah. couple episodes in the last month or two.
There's a reason why this is episode 27. And yeah. I think we want to make it so that you can just listen to episode 27 by itself. But there's 26 episodes before this that if your reaction to hearing this is like, wait, this is bonkers, there's a whole build up to this. There's a reason why we're talking about this.
So you got to be kind of an expert, I think, in Google Earth, because you yeah. were able, maybe you won't call yourself that, but you were able to take some of these paths and recreate them with these probability routes. I know that's what
well,
I'm calling them.
I should clarify a little bit.
Okay.
That when I... Okay, so when MH17 got shot down, I became super, super, super suspicious that yeah. the plane went south. I'm like, this really looks like an operation to the north. And I was at, the DSTG had not yet published the image that we've put on the screen. I basically myself just, as I've said before, the rings, the BTO rings themselves kind of tell you
yeah.
where the plane wanted to go. They're sort of like the speed that the plane flew is kind of embedded in the rings, and they right. match what a plane would do. So I was able to figure out where the plane would have gone if it went north. Later, the Australian officials published this much more rigorously scientifically generated series of, you know, routes. But it pretty matches pretty well.
Yeah, you weren't way off. You weren't. So this was definitely something that people were talking about back then.
So, well, even before people were talking about it, I was looking at it. I was trying to figure out, is this something I should publish or not? And so I started playing with Google Earth, which is this amazing tool that had only recently become available. And it allowed me to really understand and grapple with this question in a way that, like, I don't have the mathematical chops to deal with three-dimensional spheres and intersecting arcs and all that. You don't need any of that. It makes it very intuitive and easy. So I was able to play with these routes. I was able to use this free satellite imagery to see what airports are there, to see what was close to the arc and so forth. And by about August of 2014, I was spending a ton of time obsessively looking at satellite maps. Can you believe that? Is that hard to believe?
I can believe it because that checks out. But you did, in fact, put some pins. Let's zoom in and put this up on the screen.
Well, let's look at the big, let's look at what the DSTG published.
Yeah.
Later, and then flip it around. And this is the view. This is my kind of like just eyeballing what I think they thought the basically the width of the path was. It kind of gets wider as you go along because, you know, the error increases as you go in time. But you wind up with this.
Like a fan, a wedge.
Like a fan or a wedge, something like that. And so the wider range image, it shows basically from an arbitrary point in the Indian Ocean where these went over India, over Nepal, over Western China, etc. And if we zoom in, we can kind of see a fan, like a little rainbow of colors. And let me just explain this a little bit. The red lines on the left and right are my kind of eyeball approximations of what the DSTG thought was like the sort of eastern and western extremity of where their probability distribution lay. So they thought it was between somewhere in between those two extremities. It's not a hard and fast line, but that's sort of like where the most of their probability lay. If you look at the colored lines, these correspond to the speed, the ground speed that this plane flew at. It's just a property of the geometry of these ping arcs that if you pick a speed, that corresponds to a route. And if you go 350 knots, that's the blue line. If you go 400 knots, it's the sort of orangish line. And then the bright green line, that's 450 knots. And personally, I think 450 knots is like the most similar to what a plane would be flying.
And actually, it kind of doesn't matter how perfectly you got this set out because you're looking at various landing spots all over these things and analyzing them. So yeah. I'm just anticipating someone saying like, well, so what? He screwed around in Google Earth. You're not saying this is the answer. You're saying this is just kind of an area where you want to see where some potential landing spots
are. If the plane went north, if we imagine that the plane went north and we imagine that they were looking for a runway, because planes need, a 777 is not a helicopter. It needs to have a runway, a fairly long runway to land. So can we find, I mean, like, if there is nothing within 1,000 miles where a 777 could land, our theory has a problem, a big problem.
Indeed. Fortunately, hey, we got one of our audience members, Keely, looked at the, this is why this is so important.
Right.
Keely is a fan of Deep Dive MH370. She looked at the map that we put up in episode 13 and she decided to search around the area and see what kind of runways that a 777 could land on. You did that too, but she continued the work even beyond, right?
I did it. Victor Ianello did it. Various people have done it. But I mean, I love that people can listen to our podcast and be like, I want to get involved. I want to do this because I'm not a physicist. I have no particular special training. I can do this. I do have some, scientific training, but and thanks to tools like Google Earth, and as I said, I mean, I was able to do kind of this is something that like the CIA would have done in the old days. But
yeah.
We can do this like kind of, it's intelligence gathering. It's open source intelligence gathering.
This is way better than like Courtney Love looking at a satellite image and thinking it was a plane.
Exactly. We haven't really
nothing
talked
against
about
Courtney
that,
Love.
But this is really, I mean, this for people to use their eyeballs to just look and see what you find. So I think she found some really interesting possibilities.
Right. So that's why I asked you how your Russian is, because every time we've tried to speak Russian, I've completely butchered it, and I'm super.
Oh, you want me to look at the like?
Well, I'll try it, but then you can correct me because Keely has. Well, first of all, you can speak a little Russian, right?
Nemnovo, a little bit. I mean, I'm terrible. I've been doing it for years. I find it very, very difficult.
It's real hard. Okay. So, well, then you can embarrass yourself instead of me because Keely found four that you've marked on this chart that we're putting up here. We've got, here we go.
Kizilorda.
Okay.
Shymkent. Taraz.
And Manas. Okay.
They're all good. I mean, they all are nice long airstrips that you could land in, but they're all good in terms of like, they're all plausible, but they all have a problem that I find a big problem. And I don't know, different people might have different opinions. My problem is this. They're all south of the seventh arc, meaning the plane would have had to go to the seventh arc, reverse course, and then come back. In most cases, a pretty significant distance. And I don't think, and I think that because this plane would have been so low, this is so close to its maximum range.
Yeah, it's on fumes at this point.
It's on fumes at this point. And as a pilot myself, it's like when you are low on fuel, you want to get down. You're like the clock is ticking. It seems to me a little implausible, not impossible, but I would be a little bit surprised if it turned out that this plane had flown to the seventh arc and then reverse course and gone to one of these places.
Can I ask you a question?
For no obvious reason or benefit.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question that you are probably going to say is stupid, but I want to say, cause I'm not a pilot.
Sure.
Is any of this terrain in this desert flat enough that you could land a 777 kind of safely in a patch of desert like they do in movies?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, listen, with a caveat that I have not been here, I have kind of looked at pictures that people take like on the ground. It kind of looks like the American West. It's like the part of sort of this scrubby kind of Mojave Desert type of thing. It's not a billiard table flat. And even if it was, it's like got bushes and rocks, and it doesn't look flat-ish really at all.
So it would not go well if you tried to
just put
it down in the desert.
I don't think it would go well. I don't think you'd be able – I think even if you did manage to put it down in one piece, I think there was a case 10 or 20 years ago where for whatever reason, like a 737 was coming into land at like New Orleans or something, and it flamed out or something in a thunderstorm. I forget the details. But it landed on like a levee, like a earth embankment, and which sounds incredible. A 737 is a substantially smaller airplane than a 777. And like the smaller the plane, I think the easier it is to land out. It's like completely simple to land like a Piper Cub out.
Yeah.
A 737, like they landed it on an embankment. I don't think you can even contemplate that kind of stuff in the 777. So, and you can't, then you could definitely not take off again.
Right. That's an important part, because if it was just sitting there, someone would see it at some point.
I mean, it might be that some obsessive compulsive person, even more obsessive compulsive than me, which is saying something, could just pour over satellite imagery and try to find a plane, trying to find a 777, like sitting in a field somewhere. It's possible.
I do have some things that I want to talk about, but I'm not going to go that far out of order. But toward the end of the episode, I have some comments and questions about that. Great. So let's instead talk about Kizilorda. Because you think that one's kind of intriguing.
So
being right on the seventh arc, right?
So I just criticized Keeley's choices, not her life choices, but her landing.
But thank you
choices.
So much, Keeley, by the way. Major shout
thank
out.
Thank you. We're very glad that you helped us. The one exception that I think maybe I agree with the possibility is Kizilorda. And this is a city. And it is really right on the seventh arc. It's kind of, its problem is that it's kind of too far to the west, meaning the plane would have gone quite fast. So I put it in like the intriguing but problematic category. Again, I want to emphasize that all of these estimates are shrouded in uncertainty. There's uncertainty in the BTO data, although it's only a couple of kilometers. There's uncertainty most of all in the fuel model, because the plane will burn fuel differently depending on a couple of factors that we don't really know about. One of them is the winds. There is data for the winds aloft, but a lot of this is kind of interpolated from a very sparse data set of like weather balloons and things, and which were then used to generate models, which had their own inaccuracies. So we don't really know what the winds were that this plane was flying through. That has a big effect on its range. Another thing we don't know about is what altitude this plane was flying at.
This is the step climbs part that you're talking about?
Right. As you burn fuel, the plane becomes lighter. And the altitude at which it flies most efficiently changes. It gets higher, generally.
Yeah.
And so so the maximum theoretical efficiency of a plane is actually gradually climbing as it loses, as it burns fuel. And because you have to remain under air traffic control, usually you fly at a certain altitude, then you change that altitude, then you change that altitude. If you were not flying under air traffic control, like this plane definitely wasn't,
right,
you could change it continuously, and maybe you could have longer range, and maybe you could get to Kizilorda. There are unknowns that we don't have. There could, also, the headwinds could have been stronger. There might have been some other. We don't. There's a lot we don't know. So all of this is shrouded.
Okay. Let's talk about the thing that I have. The phrase that I've been waiting since like April to talk about.
Nice. Okay.
The dirt mound.
The dirt mound. Oh, well, no, wait. Have we gotten ahead of ourselves? Because yes, I definitely want to talk about the dirt mound. A story of madness and obsession.
Well, we're going to explain why we're talking about the dirt mound because beyond Kizilorda is a green oval on your map.
Okay.
About 56 kilometers across.
The minute I started to think about the northern route, I was in the independent group. We were trading ideas back and forth. We didn't know that it didn't go north at first. We didn't have this BFO data sorted out. And there was a guy whose name will come up again. In fact, I think we might do a whole episode about him because he's quite a character. It's a guy named Richard Godfrey, who was one of the independent group. In just sort of in passing, he tossed out that the speculation, like, what if the plane went to Baikonur? And I was like, interesting. Now, as you look at this map, you'll see that there's a green oval that's beyond Kizilorda. And this is called Baikonur. And Baikonur is an extremely interesting thing. It is a, it's like 56 kilometers across. It is Russian administered territory within Kazakhstan. Why is it a Russian administered territory within Kazakhstan? Because it's the Baikonur Cosmodrome. It's where back when the Soviets under Stalin started their space program, they put it here in the middle of nowhere, super top secret thing. Yuri Gagarin took up to space from here. And so this is Russian territory. And so if you're looking, if you're asking yourself, well, where did the would a bunch of Russian special forces team take a plane? You would think, well, it's right practically next door to Baikonur. Like, that would be a very friendly.
I mean, it's kind of like the Russian equivalent of Guantanamo Bay with the United States. Like, it's a part within a place. A place within
Exactly. Exactly. And one of the things that I, as I sort of read up on it, I thought it was really fascinating that the longest runway in Kazakhstan is at Baikonur. It's not the main airport that they actually use to fly the civilians in and out and bring in VIP teams and stuff. It's actually kind of off by itself in the kind of in the middle of nowhere, even in this thing itself, which is in the middle of nowhere. And it was designed to like within millimeter accuracy because it was designed. The reason it was built was to be the landing place of the Russian space shuttle. It was called the Buran.
Yep.
And they didn't want to put cosmonauts on it. I think they didn't have a lot of faith in it, or maybe they just wanted to keep it simple. And it was basically a self-landing, a space plane. And this was like way ahead of its time. And they probably had, this was before like all the computers and everything that we have now. They had,
it was like 1988, right?
Yeah. It was like, but it was engineered like,
yeah.
All this stuff started in like the 70s, right?
Sure.
So they were using much more constrained technology. So they, so in order to make their job of landing the space plane easier, they had to make this giant, really big runway that was super, super flat. And so this was interesting to me because what I was contemplating was, what if this 777 MH370 had been hijacked by people who were basically, you know, James Bond or, you know, thugs, really espionage guys from the GRU, and their job was to take over a plane. They weren't pilots per se, but they were just plugging in an autopilot. Now the 777 is capable of what's called Cat 3 approaches, so you can actually land this thing in zero visibility fog because it'll land itself. It's a self-landing airplane. It's a whole generation after the Buran was built,
of course,
and so it was a time when computers and computer control were much more advanced, and so this is now something that's commercially available. So I thought it would be kind of fascinating if the Russians had a plan to steal a plane that was capable of self-landing, and took it to the world's like kind of first and only runway that was built specifically as a place to land a self-landing airplane.
So you're talking about Yuba Laney. It's 15,000 feet long.
Right.
And they did successfully land the Russian space shuttle.
Yeah, we have footage of that, which we will put up.
It only missed its mark by like 50 feet.
Yeah, not bad.
So good job,
if
Russia.
If they could only have run the economy as well as they ran the brain.
Right. And notably, obviously, after the fall of the Soviet Union, this project was canceled and... It's a bunch
of
derelict
one of them was
destroyed.
They had built two. One of them was destroyed in a hangar collapse. And I think the other. Yeah, I'm not. Don't quote me on any of this.
Yeah, there might be parts of these things. I saw some like abandoned photos and stuff. It was kind of interesting.
Yeah. No, it's okay. I mean, it was really. It was. I think it was like at the time, I remember being, you know, an American when the space shuttle came out, and it was really hailed as this kind of Buck Rogers futuristic thing. And I think the verdict of history is that it was kind of a dead end. It was not a great idea. The fact that we lost two of them along with our crews kind of cast a pall over it. And in retrospect, I think historically the Buran was just an attempt by the Soviet Union to copy us and to keep up with us, which probably ultimately I think was the fact that they kept doing this and sort of copying our mistakes was sort of a reason for the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Well, the space race was weird. There was a lot of questionable motives for why countries were doing what they were doing.
Yeah.
It's a conversation for another day.
Yeah, for sure. So anyway, I was fascinated by Yuba Laney. And I thought this was, and so this was like, something, let me look at it and see if, let me take a look, see what it looks like. And I was particularly interested to know if there was like a hangar, like if there's a big hangar that you could park a 777 in, that would be intriguing to me. Mm-hmm. I looked around and I didn't see a hangar like that.
After the shootdown of MH17.
Yeah.
This got you thinking.
Right. So I had spent the like July and August really intensively looking at Google Earth and Yuba Laney, and I didn't see anywhere at Yuba Laney where you could hide a 777 like a hangar or anything. I was especially interested to see if like a hangar was built before, you know, March 8th, 2014. And I kind of scanned around and I couldn't really see anything. But then the most recent image in Google Earth was like 2012. And there was just, it looked like the whole area had been kind of abandoned. Mm-hmm. Then I started to look at commercial satellite photography. And again, this is something that had become very recently available, where you could sit in your house and over the internet order kind of state-of-the-art satellite imagery that was fairly recent. And to my kind of surprise and intrigue, I found that something had happened near, like about a mile from the airstrip at Yuba Laney.
It's the dirt mound. It's time to talk about the dirt mound.
I think it's time to talk about the dirt mound.
You used TerraServer, which had more update imagery.
I used TerraServer. I used a bunch of different satellite services because different ones would have different images. And I went completely down a rabbit hole. I got really, really obsessed. And I think you'll see why. I became completely obsessed with the idea that maybe I had found MH370.
So let's put up the screen. Let's put up the 2012 screen. And now let's put up October 2013, which was 5 months before the plane disappeared.
Okay.
Tell me what's going on here.
For decades, let's speak to the first one. For decades, nothing happened. This is a remote place of Kazakhstan, an abandoned space plane project. It failed, and everything was left to kind of crumble. There was just like crap lying around, and apparently from people who have been there, just the desert surrounding Baikonur is just filled with junk, like abandoned bunkers and just like scrap metal that just gets left. The Russians aren't really known for their kind of super tidiness, I will say. I don't mean that as a slur, but it's just, I think that's true.
It's just not a priority.
So
let's leave it. Yeah.
Let's not dig ourselves up.
That's kind of how I am. That's kind of how I am with
that. I'm super not. This is basically like my backyard. It looks like my backyard.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. So I'm not saying that I'm better than them.
Okay.
So 2013, 5 months before the plane disappeared.
Come to find, in October of 2013, these decades of desuetude and abandonment come screeching to a halt. And there's this place that's about a mile from the landing strip where stuff is happening. What is happening? So there's this kind of, I think of it as a 6-story building. I'm not exactly sure how tall it is, but it's like a moderately sized building. It's not a skyscraper per se, but it's like an apartment block. And next to it, they've built this rather tidy dirt patch. It's a rectangular patch of dirt with mounds of dirt. There's a sort of tall mound at one end. You can see from the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And then it looks like actually streaks of dirt that are about the same width as a bulldozer going back and forth. And at the northern end, you see there's more tall piles of dirt and what looks like a hole, like a kind of rectangular hole with maybe like a ramp going down into it at the northern end. That's what I see. I spent like a lot of time staring at this image. Yeah, it's like a trench. It looks like a trench going into like a hole. I don't know. That's what it looks like to me. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Anyway, that's October of 2013. That's about, what, 5 or 6 months before the plane disappeared. Fall is setting in. Winter is coming. They've decided to do this thing. And what's really interesting is when I like used the tools in Google Earth to measure how wide this pile of dirt was, this rectangle of dirt, and I compared it to how big a 777 is, and it's... Look at that picture.
I mean, that's okay. This is freaking me out because
it's the same size. Is it
like really exactly the same size?
Right.
You feel good about the accuracy of your scale here? Because it's not just a little bit similar to the size of a 777. It is exactly the size of a 777.
So this is where like the hair on the back of my neck started to go up.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy moly. So I actually was not earning any money at this point because I was just staring at satellite pictures. I was actually ordering satellite images, and I actually tried to do a deal with one of these companies to give me multiple ones because I really wanted to figure out what was going on. So I accumulated some pictures, and I'll show you what I found. Okay, so the next one is in December. Now, snow has fallen. The dirt patch is... I spent a lot of time matching these two things up. The southern end is the same. It now has it's now covered in snow. The building has been almost completely dismantled. The northern end of the dirt rectangle has moved. It now looks like a long trench instead of whereas before the trench was like a third of the width. Now it goes the whole way. But it's hard to tell if there's a hole or that's just a shadow. Really hard to tell.
And to reiterate, this is 4 months before MH370 disappeared.
3 months.
Before. 3 months. Okay.
Right.
I don't know exactly what day in December it is, but yeah, pretty close.
The next one is January 9th. A pretty good snow has fallen. You can actually see the tracks, like the truck tracks going from where the building's almost completely dismantled up to the northeastern corner of this, where there's now it seems like there's two streaks, like clearly something's happening between the building and the northern end of this dirt pile. The southern end of the dirt pile looks like it hasn't changed since October. So everything is happening in the north. What are they doing? Are they burying this material? I don't know. And then so that's January. There's kind of a gap in this coverage. And then I found another really pretty clear picture 2 days before the plane disappeared. And you can see where they have made this rectangle of dirt. It is not covered in snow. Pretty much to the north and west and south is covered in snow. And then where the building was, it's also not covered by snow. It looks like the building's now completely gone. And there's still junk lying around, but the building is gone.
Okay.
Then
the next photo we have is 8 days after the plane disappeared.
So in the mental state that I was in when all this was happening, I was like, is this the final resting place of MH370? Have I solved the greatest aviation mystery? And I was like, it's different, right? It's like this 2 days before and 8 days after looks really different. And I was like, I think that there was a hole and then they filled it in. And what did they fill in it with? Probably MH370. I was like, I feel like I have this site where they buried MH370. And I started like researching. It turned out that there was a Russian guy who had trespassed into this area. He had camped out at the Ubulani airstrip and like spent the night in like an abandoned bunker or something, and took pictures and posted it onto like Google Earth or one of these mapping sites. And then he went to the Buran assembly plant or wherever, the launch pad or something, and he got arrested. But he was like, he was a Russian guy wearing a I Love Buran t-shirt, and they like gave him a cup of tea and sent him on his way. I don't think that but I was like, if he can do it, I can do it. So I started so I'm like, I'm going to go there and I'm going to get like a metal detector and I'm going to sneak in. I'm going to spend the night in the bunker and then I'm going to like, my head was spinning.
This is the worst idea you could have possibly, I mean, you're a parent.
I know. I had babies. I had literal babies.
What the hell were you thinking? I mean,
well, I wanted to find the plane.
All right. So what happened? Did you do it? Why didn't you do it? Or did you do it?
Why didn't I do it? I thought I'd solve this mystery. Why didn't I do it? And this is why I didn't do it. By the way, this is what this place looks like today. This is like recently, like in the last, I don't know, within the last year or something. It looks like nothing, right?
Yeah.
All the like, there's these sort of like long rectangular white things. I don't know if they're like Jersey barriers or something. I tend to think of them as like Jersey barriers. I don't know what they are, but they've been lying there unmoved for a decade. Like nothing happened for decades and decades. Then they did all this flurry of activity right before MH370 disappeared. They finished it right before MH370 vanished, and then they haven't touched it since. But I spent all this time like making these GIFs of like, I superimposed one satellite image from the other. And because the satellite, when the satellite takes the pictures, it takes them from slightly different angles, you get a kind of binocular effect.
Yeah.
And so you get this, I'll put it on the show page. You actually can like look at the GIF and it's like,
get some like dimensions shifts, or
so
some,
you can kind of
some
get a binocular
sort of
sense.
Depth, I guess.
I stared at it. And I stared at like other like smokestacks in the vicinity and like other buildings and landmarks. And I basically, after much, much staring and thinking, I convinced myself that this wasn't a hole that had gotten filled in. It had been a pile of dirt all along. And what's more, between 2 days before and 6 days after, nothing had changed. It only looked different because the snow had melted. But actually, every single like little divot of dirt you can match from one image to the other.
So what you're saying is, based on, despite what you initially thought, it wasn't a hole. It was something that was above ground, and therefore, presumably, the plane wasn't in that pit.
I went
there was
from
no pit.
Being like 80%, 90% certain that I'd found MH370 to like 99% sure that I hadn't. There's still something about this that is like under my skin. And I think the thing that most intrigues me is that in that first October image, it really looks like they're digging a hole. And I sort of sometimes imagine like that they built like an underground chamber, and that when MH370 landed, they chopped it up or blew it up and like put the things in there. But I think that's really unlikely. And I think that it doesn't make sense. I mean, I think like the simplest thing to do, there's no reason to dispose of MH370 at Ubulani, even if it did land in Ubulani. The simplest thing to do would be just to put fuel on it and fly it somewhere else where you've like had time to like really, you know, probably brush it proper.
I have so many questions for you, but I'm just going to wait. So you did look into buying a ticket to Kazakhstan, but ultimately you opted against it because you didn't believe that you had found the thing, or did you?
I kind of heartbrokenly came out of my rabbit hole and I was like, okay, I spent thousands of dollars that I really didn't have. And I to my mind, I'm like, okay, well, at least this means I'm not a conspiracy theorist, because I think a true conspiracy theorist never would have let go. I would have like ridden this into the grave. And like the fact that you can look at something and ultimately decide that you're wrong is, I think, a mark of sanity. So I took that as a win.
Speaking of riding into the grave, I think had you showed up with your metal detector, that might not have ended particularly well for you. So I'm glad
probably
you chose
not
to do that.
But what sort of a coda to this story is that when I was, it did like really, it killed me that I had spent all this money on a dead end. And then that following March, I was telling my editors at New York Magazine about this whole interlude, and they were kind of fascinated. They were like, oh, you should write an article about it. And the article was called How Crazy Am I to Think I Know What Happened to MH370? And it was kind of like making fun of my whole theory, even though like 10 years later, I still think it's probably true. But I was like, okay, this is my opportunity to expense this imagery. And so basically I did a sidebar for them where I'm like, this is like this crazy rabbit hole I went down. And I wrote that sidebar partly because I think it's kind of interesting and partly because I wanted to expense these images.
From New York.
Does that make sense to you?
It makes total sense to me. I just
you're a freelancer, really right? It's like every time you have an expense, you want to try to get someone else to reimburse
you for
it. I
hope your editors aren't listening to this.
I think it's legitimate. I generated content and I charged them for my expenses. I mean, it's not maybe, you know.
I don't know how expensive satellite photos are per photo. Are they expensive?
It could range. I mean, it can really range on the size and everything. I forget. It was a while ago. It was thousands of dollars and I really was broke. But
if one of my writers came to me with that kind of expense report, I would probably decline it.
What if they told you that this happened 10 years ago?
Then I would probably be fine with it. So
I'm
glad it worked out, Jeff.
There's one more thing I want to say.
Yeah, go on.
Which is that because I published it because I wanted to get reimbursed, not because I thought it was true. And I think I made it pretty clear in the sidebar that I don't think this is where MH370 ended up. But people are like, for years after, people are like, oh, you're the guy who thought they buried it in a dirt pile. And I'm like, I specifically did not say that.
I'm not dissuaded, by the way, because first of all, you told me that you did actually talk to some construction experts who said that perhaps this was just a remediation type of situation. The construction debris was thrown in a trench, covered up. Well, that doesn't sound like remediation to me at all. That sounds like just throwing your garbage in a trench. I don't know.
I agree. I mean, the timing is uncanny, no question about it. And I think this kind of gets back to an idea that we talked about with the simulator, which is it is possible for crazy, unlikely coincidences to happen.
Victor Ianello, we've talked about him a lot. He spent a fair time puzzling over this in the different landing spaces.
And so in early 2015, he decided to take a more rigorous scientific approach. And he was like, okay, I was basically willing to say, okay, the plane went north. Let's find a runway. Victor was like, okay, let's look at the fuel burn. He did a very rigorous analysis of like what the winds were, how much fuel a plane would have burned, like where he tried to narrow down where this plane could have gone. And what he wound up concluding was that Kizilorda and New Blaney are just way too far to the west. It would have required going too fast, and going too fast means burning too much fuel. I mean, maybe you could kind of imagine some scenario where through step climbing, they manage to get far enough that they could then, you know, do a post-fuel exhaustion glide. It's all super dicey and like kind of unlikely.
I gotta say that I know you guys aren't on particularly great terms right now, but I have to give some props to Victor. This guy did a ton of high-quality research.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and we were completely like hand in glove until
the Blaine stuff.
Well, the Blaine stuff, really. I mean, he was skeptical even after because we were kind of joking, saying like, if the Russians took this, they would have taken the care to plant some debris to make it look like. And so we sort of thought that the absence of debris was itself kind of like a problem with our theory. He was very much on board with me. And then he was even skeptical about Blaine's piece. But then eventually, very soon after that, he came around. He's like, Blaine must be telling the truth. Blaine must be on the up and up, et cetera.
I know he's not going to do this, but Victor, if you're watching this, and I hope you are, but maybe you aren't, I really want you to come on the show because I want to hear this straight from the Victor's mouth.
Yeah, I mean, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but I do feel like ultimately a good goal of this podcast in terms of like global goals would be to try to get a kind of blue ribbon panel / trial by jury where you get some experts to kind of sit in judgment and Victor gets to present his view of what happened and I get to present my view of what happened and let the experts decide. And I know that Victor would totally do this. We've actually talked about it. I mean, not talked about it, but we like exchanged.
I hope that happens. Let's move on to the next thing. Yeah. So, okay. You guys, or Victor specifically, thought that the plane probably, MH370 probably would not make it to Kizilorda,
right?
Or even the Cosmodrome, but they could have had no problem reaching the capital of Kazakhstan, the airport at Almaty.
Right. So there's a big internet. There's actually a couple of airports around Almaty.
Almaty. And,
I mean, it used to be called Alma-Ata, and then it was Almaty. Okay. Somebody can correct me if I'm mispronouncing it. He also was looking at places further east. He was even looking at places in China. There's a place called Kucha Chuchi. Definitely mispronouncing that.
Yeah, probably.
But I feel like going into China is like a whole nother narrative. But Almaty is fascinating because it is. So Victor, who, to be clear, does not think that the plane went north anymore.
Right.
He has vehemently said that he does not, even though he, if you've listened to all 26 previous episodes, you will know that Victor did a lot of the mathematical heavy lifting and produced a whole paper kind of explaining how a spoof would work, etc. But then he doesn't believe it actually was carried out. However, so he did this work basically and said, I think that this plane had enough fuel to get to Almaty without too much trouble. And if you look at where Almaty lies in comparison to the Seventh Arc, this is to me pretty incredible. It's like right on the Seventh Arc.
Okay, I gotta stop you. Would that not have been the most conspicuous thing in the world to land a 777 at the second largest runway in Kazakhstan, like a public international airport, I'm assuming? Or would someone would have seen this, right?
I don't think that people pay attention to airplanes landing at airports. Like if you live in an airport, planes come into land all the time. And when a plane comes into land, it doesn't make that much noise. I mean, the throttles are throttled back. It kind of comes in. Where it makes the most noise is when it takes off. It's heavy and it's like climbing. So I think a plane coming in the early morning, or most people are asleep, comes in, it lands. I just don't think that it wouldn't even cross people's consciousness. I live in this town where there's this, you might have heard it because it goes off from time to time. There's this deafening horn that goes off. And I don't even hear it anymore. And so if you're living next to an airport, I don't think you'd pay any attention at all.
Plus, it would have been kind of like dawn at this point, right? Or the sun fully up?
I haven't really done the math on Almaty. I do know that at Baikonur, it would have been like an hour and a quarter before dawn or something. And, maybe the light's growing in the sky. I think it's like shortly before dawn. And so you could land, refuel, take off, and like you wouldn't be seen by satellites.
And probably if I were flying that plane, I would turn off some of the exterior lights. Just saying. I don't want to light up the Malaysia Air logo. I don't know.
For sure. Yeah, for sure.
Now I'm just wildly speculating. Anyway, so you like this?
So Almaty. So we're not saying that it went to Almaty necessarily, but it's a very good candidate. And we at the top of the show we said, if there's nowhere to land this plane within 1,000 miles, that's a big problem. So it turns out that that's not a problem, that there's at least one like super compelling candidate for where this plane could have gone.
And the crux of this issue is that as long as it had somewhere to land in Kazakhstan and then go to the next place or be disposed of, maybe we'll never find out exactly where it landed, but all of these places or some of these places have some measure of probability to them.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that if there's a problem with Almaty, it's that it's to the east. It lies to the east of the DSTG probability distribution.
Okay.
And the extent to which that's a problem, we just don't really know. We don't exactly know how the DSTG generated their parameters. We don't know how wide that kind of egg yolk kind of distribution really is. And that kind of sort of Gaussian probability distribution is built for a situation in which everything occurs sort of with random probability. And when you get into a situation where like somebody might have needed to make a turn to base or something, you're turning to maneuver to an airport, that might kind of make the technique unsound, as it were.
Okay. All right, I've been holding these back. I have a couple questions that I've been waiting for you to answer. And we didn't talk about this in the our pre-show meeting because I wanted to get your spontaneous answer.
You're hitting it to me. I'm getting hit fresh.
So get ready. Okay, so we have talked often about how radar does not cover the world. Like there's not this like eye in the sky that is constantly showing everything.
Yeah.
So it had that plane landed, refueled, put in a new pilot who knew how to fly the plane, taken off undercover. Would you say that by being in Kazakhstan, by being part kind of a client state of the former Soviet Union, that we would also not know, the West, that is, would not have known where it went after that? Were they home free once they got into Kazakhstan?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, definitely, if you're the GRU, you know, if you're Russian military intelligence or any arm of the intelligence apparatus of the state, then yeah, you know where the radars are turned on or off. You can have the radars turned on or off.
Right.
So I don't, it seems to become all these problems become trivial after that point.
The reason I ask is because then there are also these satellite photos that are available to everyone, but had it sat on this runway for too long, the next day there would have been pictures of a plane sitting there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if it landed, it had to get out of there, whether it be in a dirt mound or taken off in kind of a hurry.
Presumably. What we don't know is, I think that if you're in this business, you know where the assets are. The disadvantage of a satellite vis-a-vis a plane is that its path is entirely predictable. Like you can set your watch by when the enemy spy satellite is overhead.
Right.
So if you time your activities to match where they are, you know, you can get away with stuff. Another consideration is that we don't know if Western intelligence knows what happened to MH370 or not. Like, we know that in the case of Syrian chemical use, Barack Obama said that there's a red line. If you use chemical weapons, we will punish you. And Bellingcat, you know, using their own open source intelligence techniques, were able to prove very compellingly that, in fact, this red line had been crossed, embarrassing the Obama administration because they didn't do anything. And so there can be incentives to pretend like you don't know stuff that you actually do know.
That's absolutely right. So my second question is actually more of like a comment than a question. You seem to feel pretty good that this plane landed safely. And I've kind of always wondered, like, okay, I understand that they intended to land it safely, but I don't see any evidence that the plane didn't crash because this was pretty complicated. I mean, stealing this plane and pulling this off would have been pretty hard. So had it crashed somewhere in a former Soviet client state, we wouldn't know about that either.
I mean, if somebody wanted to undertake a visual search of satellite photography from that era and like look within, you know, 100 miles of the Seventh Arc and see if they can find scorch marks, I think it would be pretty visible. And I've looked around, not in a super methodical or detailed way, but like I wouldn't object to that project at all.
And really the reason I'm asking you about this is you believe that the plane actually landed and didn't crash, because I don't have any certainty about either one of those outcomes. And ultimately it wouldn't have really changed anything if they wanted to plant pieces.
Right.
So, you know, why do you think it landed and took off again?
I don't have any evidence that it landed and took off again. I just think that of all the difficult things that they would have had to accomplish in order to pull this off, I feel like just landing it would be trivial. I mean, I just, it's not that hard to land a plane.
And although it was pretty low on fuel, it had a narrow band of places it could pull this off. But
one of the major obstacles to the whole spoof scenario is fuel burn. Like, you're positing that somebody planned to steal this plane, fly it in the other direction, and get it to a place where they could have landed without running out of fuel. And when I was thinking about Baikonur pretty much exclusively, I always thought that like the fuel burn was like the major problem of the whole hypothesis. Once you start looking at Almaty and you're like, oh, actually it's fairly easy to get there, that problem kind of goes away. But the bottom line is, look, the plane either went north or went south. Mm-hmm. That's what the Inmarsat data says. And so if it's not in the southern seabed, it has to be north. And so whether it was low on fuel or had plenty of fuel, whether it landed at Almaty or Baikonur or Kizilorda or some recently bulldozed place in the middle of nowhere, I mean, it had to have somewhere wound up there. Whether it crashed or landed, it doesn't really matter. Those are the options.
That's frustrating because that's going to be, we just may never know.
Well, for a long time, my thought was, if I can find these Russians alive, then I will have solved the case. And I've spent a fair bit of time doing that. And I can tell you, I do not have these guys alive. They could be alive.
Put a pin in that because we have more to discuss. I feel like this is a good place to wrap things up.
Yeah.
27 episodes through. This is the time when we remind people to like and subscribe, to consider becoming a member of our YouTube channel. If you are the type that listens to the audio version of this on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts, we'd encourage you to take a look at the video version. Go back, look at some of these episodes that we referred to. Also, check out our show page because it's a heck of a lot more detailed than anything that you and I can ramble about for an hour. And that's at deepdivemh370.com, where you can also subscribe. You can do a free subscription and get stuff, or you can support us through that. And we're putting all of this right back into the podcast to continue to grow and to get awesome content like we got from Keely.
Yeah.
Super cool. Thank you, Keely.
Yeah, we really love that. We've been getting great questions, great insights. People are just volunteering their expertise. So there's a couple of threads, actually, that I've been able to open, kind of lines of inquiry that had kind of been lying dormant, but people have like just volunteered their expertise. And it's very exciting, actually.
It is exciting. So if you are interested in being a sponsor of Deep Dive MH370, visit our show page, deepdivemh370.com. Drop me an email at andy@onmilwaukee.com. Like to thank Jacob John, our Seattle Tacoma based singer songwriter, for our awesome bumper music. Still love it. And next week we jump into the why part. That's going to be a fascinating and long and deep conversation, Jeff.
Yeah, no, for sure.
So thanks again, Jeff, for taking your Sunday afternoon to make this thing happen.
Thank you, Andy. And thank you to all our listeners and viewers and for all the people who have helped us in various ways.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.